the headlines. The Yemeni army says it has held a large-scale military operation against several targets inside Saudi Arabia. The White House says a stronger U.S. military presence in Eastern Europe and severe economic harms will wake Russia if it moves to invade Ukraine. Also in the headlines, China says the U.S. will fail to disrupt the Winter Olympics and warns that a diplomatic boycott will only result in a loss of moral authority. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Yemeni army releases the details of its latest military operation against Saudi Arabia, coming in response to the kingdom's escalating attacks and continued siege. The army spokesman says a large number of drones and ballistic missiles were launched at military sites and other key locations in the Saudi cities of Abha, Jizan, Asir, and the capital Riyadh. Yahya Sari says the army also targeted the Aramco oil facilities in Jeddah. He called military sites the legitimate targets of the Yemeni army, urging Saudi residents living near those areas to evacuate. Sari said the Yemeni army would respond to aggression with escalation. On Monday, Saudi Arabia bombed Sana'a, the latest in over 100 raids against Yemen in the past 5 days. Abdul Latif al-Washali is our correspondent joining us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. We had this report that came out yesterday in the form of breaking news indicating that a number of areas were bombed and also a number of casualties. If you can tell us about that and in turn also what we're seeing are the offensives and the incursions by the Yemeni army. Yahya Sari spoke about an hour ago. If you can also give a summary of that, please, Abdul Latif, if you can.
Thank you so much. First of all, we all know that these attacks would never happen if the Saudi regime did not attack the Yemeni people, did not escalate its aerial attacks against the Yemeni civilians, and did not launch a deadly war against Yemen in the first place. So the Saudi regime is the one who is making these attacks legitimate by attacking Yemen and violating the sovereignty of the country. The Yemeni army, by the way, did not only attack Saudi Arabia yesterday. Simultaneously, there were several attacks on other military sites in the Marib governorate and other regions inside Yemen. They attacked the military camps of the Saudi-led coalition's forces. The Yemeni army is only responding to the Saudi attacks against the Yemeni civilians. You can't attack a country, you can't attack a nation, and expect that these people will not hit back at you and your facilities. The Yemeni army has only attacked the facilities used for military purposes, such as the airports and also the military sites inside the kingdom. The Yemeni army has earlier vowed the Saudi regime that if they did not stop escalating their attacks against the Yemeni civilians, the Yemeni army will absolutely respond to the attacks and launch a wider and larger operations. Today, the Yemeni army used 25 drones, and this is the largest number until the moment, and a large number also of missiles, and this proves that the growing missile capabilities of the Yemeni army. We will also be witnessing other attacks if the Saudi-led coalition did not stop its escalating and did not stop its aerial attacks against the Yemeni civilians.
Thank you for that. Abdul Latif al-Washali, a correspondent there from Sana'a. Moving on, Israel carries out fresh air raids on Syria, targeting the port city of Latakia several times. Syrian defense systems have intercepted several missiles. No casualties have been reported in the incident. Roughly an hour ago, a powerful bomb explosion ripped through Iraq's key port city of Basra in the south. Reports coming out of the country suggest at least 4 people are dead. Local police say that a motorcycle laden with explosives went off in the city center near a hospital. Several others have been injured, and a number of vehicles have been damaged. Videos posted online show a column of black smoke rising from the site of the explosion. There is no claim of responsibility yet. A note of warning from Iran's foreign minister to the United States and the 3 European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. The window of negotiation will not be open forever. In an article written for Russian newspaper Kommersant, Amir Abdullahian says the main goal of the Vienna talks should be to effectively implement the deal. He notes that Iran will not accept any demands that go beyond the accord. He also notes that Iran is prepared to return to compliance with the deal in case all sanctions are removed in a verifiable manner. He has also questioned Washington's will to remove the sanctions, saying that Tehran has an effective toolkit to neutralize their effect on its economy. The seventh round of talks between Iran and the P4 plus one went into recess on Friday. They're expected to pick up where they left off in Vienna later this week. Iran says the cross-border movement of cultural objects is illegal and that international cooperation is needed to stop the trafficking of nations' heritage. On Monday, a UN meeting adopted a resolution on the return of cultural property to the countries of origin. Speaking at that meeting, Iran's UN ambassador, Majid Tahtaravanchi, urged the world to cooperate to stop such coercive measures. As a case in point, he pointed out the illegal excavations of Palestinian heritage by the Israeli regime. He also said that Iran is ready to offer technical assistance to other countries, especially those hosting its ancient artifacts. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Iran has been hosting several meetings with officials from regional states this week in an effort to boost security and stability in West Asia. President Ebrahim Raisi met with the Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad in Tehran on Monday. Discussing the situation in Syria, President Raisi said the illegal presence of foreign forces in West Asia is detrimental to regional security and stability. The President also met with the UAE National Security Advisor, Sheikh Tahnoon bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the same day. During the meeting, President Raisi reiterated Tehran's support for peace and security in the Persian Gulf region. Head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council also met with an Emirati official. Ali Shamkhani said durable peace and security can only be achieved through dialogue and cooperation among regional countries. The Syrian and Emirati officials also held discussions with Iran's top diplomat, Hossein Amir Abdullahian. Fotizadeh, university professor and political analyst, joins us. We also have John Stepling, who's an author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Welcome to you both. Fotizadeh, let me first start with you. So we're looking at this, I don't know if I should call it a flurry of diplomatic activity, but it certainly is a departure from the past, and it's in line with what Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, has said. The most recent visit from the UAE to Iran being an example. Tell us how you view this.
Well, as you know, the United States is a country in decline, and a number of American allies in this part of the world are realizing it. They are realizing that the Trump administration's lack of interest in supporting its allies in this part of the world has continued, and the Biden administration is more or less following the same policy. This is because the United States did the power in decline. The way they left Afghanistan, they ran away from Afghanistan. The way they failed in Syria and in Yemen and in Lebanon and Iraq and elsewhere is an indication that relying on the United States is not going to be a good foreign policy option. Because of that fact, UAE at least is realizing that working with Iran, having better relations with Iran is going to be their interest because the United States is not going to be an effective power in this part of the world. And this is what Iran has been calling for many decades. Iran wants to have good relations with its neighbors. Iran has called for extraterritorial powers to leave this part of the world because they caused difficulties for the people of this region. They gained in wars, they killed people. Yeah, and I think we are moving towards the right direction.
The most recent move by the UAE is very interesting, John Stepling. Aside from the visit to Iran, also I believe it was the UAE foreign minister who visited Syria. And then you're looking at Saudi Arabia calls it exploratory channel that has opened up with Iran. So you have talks there. And, of course, other movements. We could talk about Turkey, the most recent gas swap deal that Iran actually had with Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan. So you can see where I'm going with this. How do you view these geopolitical moves that are happening?
Your other guest touched on maybe the key factor here. The U.S. is in decline. And it's interesting that the UAE is meeting with Iran. The U.S. has a large base in the UAE, but then it's important to remember the U.S. has bases in Kuwait and surrounding Iran. They have bases throughout the entire Middle East, and they have proxies in Israel. And I know that bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, is about to embark on a tour. I think he'll probably meet with Erdogan, who's going to Qatar and the UAE and so forth. These are all the Gulf states, I think, across the board, view the U.S. with increasing suspicion. They don't really want the U.S. there. They don't really want those bases there. And this wasn't the case, say, 20 years ago. So the U.S. is running out of options. It's running out of leverage at the same time that you see this global economic restructuring that I've mentioned before, which is taking place against the backdrop of the pandemic and the lockdowns and so forth, which has gutted certain economies. It certainly hurt small businesses in the U.S. and caused massive unemployment problems for the U.S. These things are all, and this is a NGO-driven great reset, as the World Economic Forum called it. So the U.S. has multiple problems. Economically, they militarily, they have bases everywhere, 900 outside their borders, but they are short of soldiers, they are short of boots on the ground, their equipment is in disrepair, they have problems servicing a lot of the equipment that they sell to places like the UAE and Saudi Arabia. So I think that the writing's on the wall, that people in the entire region, including Africa, all of Africa, are increasingly seeing the U.S. As vulnerable and unable to act on the threats they make. And certainly Iran is aware of this, and Iran looms as ever more important. I mean, the other thing, remember, it's like about a year ago that the U.S. assassinated General Soleimani. This and Obama had all of those assassination raids for 3 years during his second term. It's important to remember this is becoming the U.S. strategy now. Rather than conventional warfare, they are targeting certain people and carrying out assassinations mm-hmm. and false flags and all the rest, because they can't do much else, frankly. And where all of this is going in terms of the reset is a whole separate discussion, but the U.S. has multiple problems and waning influence, I think.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Fouad Rezaadi, many thanks to University Professor and Political Analyst John Stepling. Thank you for your thoughts and comments. Author and commentator from Inderøy, Norway. And with that, we come to an end for this news interview. Thanks for tuning in. Rhetoric ratcheting up between the U.S. and Russia just hours ahead of a meeting between their leaders. Washington now says Moscow will have to prepare for a stronger U.S. military presence in Eastern Europe should it move to attack Ukraine. A senior White House official says Washington would give a positive response to Eastern European allies requesting additional U.S. troops and military hardware to counter any threat from Russia. He also says that Russia will face severe economic consequences in case of invading Ukraine. Kremlin says it is not expecting any significant breakthrough in the upcoming talks between President Vladimir Putin and his U.S. counterpart, Joe Biden. Two leaders are set to hold a video call in the coming hours for a conversation that will include several issues. The White House says it is concerned over the Russian military buildup near Ukraine, warning that massive sanctions are on the way.
It's not about threats. It's about conveying that the right path forward here is through diplomacy. In the meantime, on financial sanctions, we have consulted significantly with our allies and believe we have a path forward that would impose significant and severe harm on the Russian economy. You can call that a threat. You can call that a fact. You can call that preparation, whatever you want to call it. But that is something we've talked about publicly, and certainly the president would convey that as well.
Washington and Kiev accused Moscow of preparing for a large-scale military offensive on Ukraine, but Moscow says that NATO is infringing upon Russia with an eastward expansion, that the country needs the military buildup to protect itself. The Indian Foreign Secretary has confirmed that Russia has begun delivering long-range S-400 ground-to-air missile system to New Delhi, despite U.S. sanctions threat. Harsh Vardhan Shringla said supplies of S-400 would continue. He made the announcement after the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi held talks with the visiting Russian President Vladimir Putin in New Delhi. The deal for the Russian missile system, worth more than $5 billion, was signed in 2018. But Washington has threatened sanctions against India over the agreement under 2017 U.S. law. The legislation is aimed at deterring countries from buying Russian military hardware. India, which is a strategic U.S. ally, needs the Russia S-400 missile system to modernize its armed forces. The U.S. diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing is drawing an angry response from China, with its foreign ministry warning that Washington will pay a price for its mistakes. The ministry says Washington's plot to disrupt the international event will fail, and that Beijing is prepared to take countermeasures. It warned that the decision would lead to a loss of U.S. moral authority and credibility. The State Department has said that U.S. government officials will not be attending the Games because of alleged human rights violations. The decision will not affect American athletes who will still compete in the Games. The standoff over the Olympics is adding to a long list of disputes between China and the U.S., including trade, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and COVID origins. And that's it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Simple question.
Who's really responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? The recent drowning of at least 27 migrants has led to renewed calls for a new approach to the ongoing crisis. caused by those trying to start a new life in the United Kingdom. While British government officials claim it is on track to fix the broken asylum system, legislation has been criticised for making it harder for those arriving by boat to claim asylum in Britain. Those who speak for refugees even say the new proposals are actually cruel.
There's a pattern to the problem. A large proportion of these migrants come from Iraq, Syria and Afghanistan, all countries torn apart by conflict supported or even started by Anglo-American military escapades. Furthermore, while the UN Refugee Agency says deaths can be avoided with coordinated action, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have fallen out after the French president objected to Mr. Johnson's accusations that France has not done enough to stop migrants crossing the Channel. The impact of these political and military conflicts has turned out to be lethal. War and conflict disrupt countries and entire regions, forcing migrants to flee. In their desperate efforts to start a new life, some pay traffickers large sums to assist them in their efforts to cross the Channel to England. This leads to illegal immigration, increasing tensions between France and the United Kingdom, and deaths in the sea, while France and Britain blame each other for the migration issue and the human toll of those who drown.
To what extent is the UK responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? And who should be creating a new place for people to live after escaping from war-torn conflicts in which the United Kingdom plays a part? Simple questions with important answers. And we begin our inquiry with a straightforward and direct question. What does the public think of the deaths of 27 migrants who drowned while trying to cross the Channel? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
A boat which is about the size as that one that goes up and down the river here, the small one. 27 people were on it and it capsized and they drowned this last week. Yeah, and they just drowned and their bodies were washed up on the shore. Yeah.
It's so sad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, things like that should not be happening in the future, of course.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I just wish that there were actually legal safe routes for people to get to Britain in order to claim refugee status.
The way that we talk about, you know, helping people and things like foreign aid, but when there's real issues like people trying to escape persecution, I think it's shameful that the government, you know, practically ignores or tries to deflect the problem.
I mean, it's just a shame, really, isn't it? I mean, it's upsetting when anyone dies, let alone migrants. I mean, there's the whole... I'm sure an overwhelming majority are just trying to escape what can be explained nothing short of an absolute travesty.
Sad and disappointed.
I don't think that's very nice to hear at all.
They have family, they have mother, father, sons, daughter, and I think we or the government need to pay the attention in that case.
I think it's a terrible tragedy. I don't think anyone deserves to die when trying to gain freedom and have the rights that we should all be given as human beings upon this earth.
Well, obviously, wasted life is always a tragedy, but it would not happen if people didn't get on broken lilos and try to cross the busiest waterway in the world in treacherous weather.
Horrific, and why don't we have a secure way whereby these people fleeing from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria are able to come to this country? I think we've opened the doors to, is it 3 million from Hong Kong? Why can't we find a humane, civilised way of helping these people?
It's very sad. It's sad that they'll have to move, like, come over here and try and find, like, obviously living over here. Like, it's sad that they have to do that, like, rather risk their life than just trying to find a better life where they actually are. I don't know, it's quite sad.
French government is responsible first because that's their border. And then the British government should... taking care of their English waters or English Channel to control the border. I think nobody should risk their life for better life.
This terrible shouldn't have never happened in the first place. I mean, they should
just have safe passage to prevent this to start with.
Firstly, I suppose, use the word tragic, and it is a tragedy. Obviously, I think everybody can be completely sympathetic to the situation. And, yeah, of course, I think everybody was greatly saddened by the situation, considering there were children involved as well, which makes it even worse.
Many are refugees from conflicts fought by Britain, including in Afghanistan, Iraq and other Middle Eastern countries. In the public's view, what responsibility does the UK have for these deaths?
I think we have a responsibility to provide safe passage for people to come here to attempt to claim refugee status. If we feel that we have the right to go and intervene in different ways around the world, then we have the responsibility to kind of follow up the results of that, I think.
Oh, we have massive responsibility. You know, it's anything that, you know, is initiated, or guns that we sell to different parties in these conflicts isn't entirely, you know, the British government's responsibility to do something about it.
There's a very, very valid argument to make that to a certain extent, intervention in certain countries has worsened political situations. I mean, the arguable thing, you know, you can look at situations like maybe Syria or Iraq. Afghanistan is a very good one, I think.
I think we're responsible if we're involved in the conflict, but we're also responsible as a better-off country to help people who are not safe.
It's hard to pinpoint the exact responsibility if the conflict that they're running from is caused by the UK, or at least contributed to by the UK. There's definitely some responsibility there, in my opinion anyway.
Well, this should be something that maybe the governments of the world should look at, and those of us who have more to give should be able to give and allow safe haven for these people.
I think we do have some responsibility for taking our fair share of refugees from conflicts that we've had a part in.
They're mainly refugees from countries which have internal problems, and that's why there was an influence from the British. And there are a number of countries that they could have stopped in along the way if they truly wanted somewhere that was just safer than where they came from.
These crossings are a consequence of us so-called global Britain meddling around in the Middle East, so we have a lot of responsibility.
I don't really know who to blame, but I'm pretty sure both sides should be responsible, like both France and the Britain part. Because is there a kind of shared channel, I guess, so...
There's some implicit responsibility because, you know, we've armed these countries, we've been involved militarily, and we haven't supported some of the kind of the transportation of the immigrants in the first place that were suffering in these countries.
That's a very loaded question. I think obviously they've travelled many miles to get to the UK. Clearly, I think there's a lot of discussion about being housed in the first port of call of whichever country they go to. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that situation, but I guess if they do get to the UK, they're entitled to a hearing. They're entitled to the civil liberties, and obviously they're entitled to actually put their case forward. And that's the problem. I don't think they do get that. And perhaps the UK needs to have a rethink on that point.
Yes, some days ago, also, I heard about the problem in Afghanistan. I think that's something that is impossible to think in the 25...
French police have been seen to watch on as many refugees board boats to cross the channel. What do people here in Britain think of the French allowing migrants to make these hazardous crossings?
The French police have watched on. They've been filmed watching on while the traffickers send the boats across. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's difficult because if they... I don't know, that's a tough one, because if they stop them, then they stop them being able to try and find somewhere safer. But at the same time, it's not a safe journey either. But I don't know, that's a tough one.
From a legal perspective, it very well could be justified. From my opinion, that doesn't come across as right.
Yeah, I wish that there was closer and better tempered and more even collaboration between Britain and France and between Britain and the rest of the EU. Over this, to be fair, it's obviously not ideal that people are being allowed to launch themselves into small unsafe boats into the channel. We've seen the result of that this year, so I wish that wasn't happening.
If these start to war, obviously we should be taking responsibility for it. So I mean, yeah.
the entire international community needs to take some responsibility and work together, like I say, to try and find a solution.
If you're seeing somebody getting on a boat that you know is probably not going to make it, I mean, in my opinion, I would be saying, don't make that crossing.
I think it's a responsibility of the French government.
Didn't see them to know if that's true or not. If it is, then they should be held accountable, but I haven't seen any evidence either way on that.
A very complex issue. I think it's wrong of them to not intervene, although there's always circumstances around everything. But I think there's always a duty of care to people, no matter who or where they come from.
I can't understand how we haven't taken back control from the French police.
I think that's part of the reason why they want to come over here, because they're just not getting looked after very well, clearly, are they? If they're getting allowed to get on the boats, it's causing tragedies and they're allowing it to happen. We're trying to stop it and they're allowing it to happen and allowing them to come while we're trying to stop.
I think British government, to be honest, because if you get involved in someone else's business, then there is always the consequences, so you have to face the consequences.
Basically, it's wherever they seek in, whichever country they look at to find asylum, that's where they should be housed in the first place.
I think what I probably would like to say, you wouldn't want to repeat, but I think that's absolutely disgusting. Clearly, if it's on the shores of the UK, we would expect the police to do their duty, and I think the same thing should apply to the French police.
The statistics underline the size of the issue and how little Britain is really doing to fix it. The Home Office plans to accept 5,000 people in the first year of the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, and up to 20,000 more afterwards. However, by late November 2021 alone, it is estimated that during this year, over 26,000 people, many from Afghanistan, had already arrived in small boats after crossing the channel illegally. Yet the Afghan conflict, in which the UK played a central role, generated 2.5 million refugees, of whom 2.2 million live in Iran and Pakistan, showing how small the UK's contribution is to fixing the problem it helped cause.
Who should be held responsible for finding new homes for refugees escaping conflicts fought by Britain?
I think a lot of responsibility therefore comes onto the government to make sure that we can give safe passage to these refugees and we can allow them in and look after them, as the conflict is our fault.
I believe they should have handled the issue like in a more precise manner.
Just because that's the country they went in first doesn't mean that country has equal responsibility for them being a refugee in the first place.
We're partly responsible, and countries should work together. Unfortunately, we seem to be global Britain going it alone, but we should work, like with the health crisis on COVID, countries should work together to solve these problems, be it climate change, refugees. It's a shame that we don't have anyone with any diplomatic skills from Lord Frost, Rab, Priti Patel, Boris, to make sure we are responsible global citizens.
It should be a shared effort between more governments. I'd say Britain, France, and whoever participated in those wars. That would seem fair to me.
Allow them to make the crossing. Letting people make something that's unsafe, where they could possibly lose their lives, is almost like a criminal act. They're complicit in the deaths, in a way, by letting that happen. Yeah.
Well, again, I think it's down to probably every country to do their part. And we hear all the figures on the media. You never know whether you're hearing the right figures or not. Fairly obviously, I think other countries in Europe probably have taken more than the UK, and possibly the UK need to rethink their policy in that respect.
Who's actually responsible for rehousing people who've been victims of conflict that Britain itself has led or been involved in?
I think if people have refugee status in Britain, then Britain is responsible for rehousing them. We shouldn't forget that Britain has, I think, around about 1% of the world's refugees here. We have a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's refugees. And if we want to see ourselves as global Britain, as a country that has a role on the global stage, then we need to step up and take responsibility for some of this.
I would not like to comment on that, yeah, but these things should not be happen. I mean, if they are watching it, they should have stopped it, of course.
I don't want to just pile blame onto my own government. It's obviously the responsibility of all governments to try and find a solution for these people.
But it is our responsibility as humans and as common man to account for one another. So not just the government, but we all, as a collective, need to step up and do something about it.
My opinion is, rather than trying to figure out exactly who is responsible, is that if you feel you can do something, and as a country, if we feel we can do something, then we just should.
What is the public's advice to the British government about refugees who risk death in the process of trying to cross the channel?
I think these practices should be stopped. I mean, force measures should be taken to stop it, because if the people are trying to cross the channel, they can lose their lives. So, yeah, of course.
My advice to government would be to work with people, with our friends and colleagues in the EU, to step up and to act more humanely, to give people safe passage routes.
If the government wants to, you know, be re-elected, they need to take action and do something about it.
There are plenty of people in the country who would want to help. It's just reaching out and maybe putting together a system where people who can help and can provide housing, or even if it's just temporary. You know, there's a lot of people with spare bedrooms.
Everybody knows it's an issue, and it's been an issue for quite some time. My advice would be stop ignoring it. Do something.
Let's try and find a way where they don't have to risk death, and we can help them if it is that we're responsible.
Oh, I think, the Britain can help people who are homeless to find homes and so on.
I would say it's a very complex situation, but human life has to be saved amongst anything else. But I think rather than spending so much time trying to dissuade people from crossing, they should look at the reason why the people are going in the first place.
Work with other countries in a diplomatic manner to find a solution.
Should be able to give them set boats and, you know, better like accommodation to come over on, rather than just a dinghy that's probably going to sink halfway across. Like, we've got the boats, we've got like all the lifeguards and everything. We could be helping save more than anything. Do you know what I mean? And we have lifeguards that swim the channels on a night time to make sure everything's all good. So we could be making things a lot safer, and communication with the other governments as well is even better. Like,
it doesn't matter what they're like, what country they came from, but their life matters. So they should be taken care of. They should have been taken care of.
Not all the immigrants are genuine immigrants. Most of them, they are economic immigrants. So finding ways to support them in their own country so they don't have to cross the borders. First place, if they have come over risking their life, then find the ways to settle them.
Create a safe passage. That's all we need, is a safe passage. They shouldn't be risking their lives in the first place. Otherwise, they are complicit in what's happening.
Again, I think we need to put something into place, a more meaningful policy in place to give these people a chance to have their story heard, to have their situation checked.
The 27 migrants who drowned in the English Channel as they tried unsuccessfully to reach British shores made the headlines. These fatalities also provoked a bitter war of words between British and French politicians after UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson attacked French authorities and, by implication, the French President himself, Emmanuel Macron, for failing to prevent the crossings.
Many make these dangerous journeys because of the impact of British conflicts on their homelands. A number of observers now believe that Britain must accept responsibility for causing much of the migrant problem. It seems a tragic irony that after travelling thousands of perilous kilometres from their war-torn homelands, desperate migrants seeking a new life drown within sight of the very country that turned them into refugees.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the scope and from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen wa Sayyid al-Muwahideen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. And we were specifically looking at the right of the family. Now, previously we mentioned that Amir al-Mu'mineen states and highlights the rights of the father and the son and the rights of one on other. And obviously, we kept it simple and short. Another thing that Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah alayhi highlights, which is a very delicate matter that sometimes, you know, families in our modern day might have to face. And obviously this issue was happening back then and continues these days. That when it comes to the father and the son. Now, as a son, I work. I earn a living. I have an income. My father might do the same. My father might have an income too. And sometimes, no, my father doesn't have income, I have an income, or vice versa. Now, do I have the right to go to my father, take money from him without his permission or not? Or does my father has a right to come take money from me without my permission? How does that, because this is a delicate matter when it comes to money. And you see, a lot of families break down in our modern age because of the issue of money. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah alayhi, he also puts the father at the top of the hierarchy. So he says the father maintains everything. He says, when he was asked about a man taking money from his son, from his kids, he says, يَأْكُلُ مِنْهُ مَا يَشَأْ بِغَيْرِ سَلَفٍ. He has the right to take from it as much as he like, obviously without, you know, wasting, without just, you know, spending the money for no good reason. He has the right to take as much as he want for his livelihood, for his needs, as long as we are not crossing the boundaries of wasting, of trying to just spend the money for no good reason. So he was very clear in that. And now, as a son, having heard Amir al-Mu'minin say so, I say on my head, on my eyes, as we say, my father can come to me, take my credit card, my bank account, and he can take as much money as he likes. And I would not object to that. Then he says, in one of his letters, in one of his books, he says, إِنَّ الْوَلَدَ لَا يَأْخُدُ مِنْ مَالِ وَالِدِهِ شَيْئًا إِلَّا بِإِذْنَهِ. As for a son, you have absolutely no right to go take money from your father's purse, from your father's credit card, from your father's bank account, unless you have permission to do so. Without permission, you have no business doing such a thing. Why? Because Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, he's trying to keep the hierarchy in place, keeping that respect happening. As a son, obviously you need your father's permission. If you break that trust, if you break this connection, then we're going to have what? A problem. And he says, وَالْوَالِدُ يَأْخُدُ مِنْ مَالِ إِبْنِهِ مَا يَشَاءُ. On the other hand, the father can come and take whatever he wants from his son. So that's just maintaining the order of things. My father, he gave me my life. He gave me everything that I have is because of him. This is exactly the words of Imam Sajjad. Huwa asluk wa anta fur'uh. He is the root, you are the branch. Whatever you have, I mean, Imam Sajjad says, whatever you have, it will not be possible if it wasn't for him. Therefore, I submit to that fact that me, my existence, and everything I own is due to my father, thanks to my father. Therefore, he has the right to come and take whatever he wants from me. Can I do the same to him? Of course I can't. Let us take a short break, then we come right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Amir al-Mu'minin salamullahi alayhi, then he moves on and he expands the circle of the family. So he is not limited to only the parents. He tries to, you know, create a bigger circle where he includes the relatives as well. Because obviously one family is one part of the society, another family is another part of society, and we increase. So then Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he talks about the benefits of having to mingle with people of your own kin, you know, your relation, cousins, brothers, I don't know, sisters, nephews, or what have you. He says you need to come together and keep this link and the relationship between you. Why all Amir al-Mu'mineen? Why is this important? He says, in such an action itself, look at the benefit. He says, مُثْرَاتٌ فِي الْمَالِ وَمُنْسَاتٌ فِي الْأَجَلِ. If you keep your relationship with your family, two things will happen. One, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will increase your wealth, and this is something that we want as human beings. And he will delay your death. And that's the second thing that human beings want. In this life itself, there are two things that me and you, we constantly seek on a daily basis. To live long and to have more money. And Amir al-Mu'minin says, well, that is simple. all you have to do is share with your relatives, go to them, give them a phone call, ask about them, give them a visit. If you do so, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will increase your wealth and will prolong your life. As simple as that. When he talks about the Jahiliyyah era, when he talks about the pagans and how they lived, he says, Al-arhamu maqtu'a. Back in the day, before Islam, relationships were severed, were cut. People don't used to care much about the relation. Wal-gharatu mashnuna. And they not only that, but they used to do what? They used to kill each other. They used to fight and go into war. Because back in the day, you would have a whole tribe consist of one family, and then you have another tribe consist of another family, and sometimes these two tribes are cousins. What happens between them? Not only the relationship between them is cut, but from time to time they invade one another. That was the pagan era. When Islam came, Islam changed that. So he included them to be one part, to be one unit. So then he says that you need to have this equality amongst you when it comes to you, your family, and other families that are related. In fact, when it comes to the entire area, city, community that you live in, you need to keep that. You need to maintain that. So he expands the circle even further. He says, من أتاه الله مالا فليصل به القرابة. He who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives him wealth, let him use it to get closer to his relatives. So sometimes you get close to your close relatives, and sometimes you have to get even closer to your further relatives. So the more you expand yourself from what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you, the more Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you in return. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi from here, he's trying to maintain the right of the family, the right of relatives, be it far or be it close. And he expands that circle and he says, okay, if you do this and he does the same thing and everyone does the same thing, then we're going to have a very beautiful society that maintains the rights of one another. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.